One thing that a lot of people don't recognize is that ethics rules are national security rules. They are rules that are designed to protect the interests of the United States.
Welcome to Foreign Policy. I'm David Rothkopf, CEO and editor, and you're listening to the ER. I'm in Washington today, and I'm joined by a new guest who I'm pleased to welcome to the table, Susan Hennessy, who is a fellow in national security and governance studies at Brookings. She's also managing editor of the Lawfare blog. Also joining us in Washington is FP columnist Julia Yaffe, who also writes for The Atlantic and Huffington Post Highline. And calling in from Palo Alto is Corey Shockey, a research fellow at the Hoover Institution, where she focuses on military history. I know all of you out there are dying for an ER mug. The demand has gotten so hot that we're now only giving out 5 mugs a week. So you've got to put on your thinking caps and send us your best episode ideas or a really pitiful plea. We often, you know, give in to those really pitiful pleas from you who say my life is empty and the only way to make me want to go on living is having an ER mug. Recently, in our tiny podcast studio high above Washington's DuPont Circle, we had the following conversation. Now, you might, Susan, ask, why did we ask you to walk the 3 blocks over here from Brookings? But I've been following you on Twitter, and you've been extremely good in dealing with these issues of ethics that have arisen around our new administration. Whenever I say new administration, we stand up in the studio out of respect. And so just visualize that when you're at home. Corey would do that, but she's in the Hoover Institute hot tub, which is a whole different story. In any event, I want to sort of deal with the intersection of ethics and foreign policy and how these two things may interplay with each other. They, I think, have special resonance with regard to the case of Russia, which is something that Julia has been following closely. And so I thought I'd start with you on just that very broad, broadly framed question. As you look at this administration and as you look at the way it's handling ethics, where do you think that's going to bump up against foreign policy interests?
Yeah, so I have certainly had a little bit of a bee in my bonnet over the Trump ethics violations of the Trump transition. You know, I think people have been surprised that I've been so focused on ethics because national security is sort of my wheelhouse. One thing that a lot of people don't recognize is that ethics rules are national security rules. They are rules that are designed to protect the interests of the United States. And so whenever you say, what do ethics rules have to do with foreign policy? What does national security have to do with foreign policy? What does good, unbiased decision making in the national interest have to do with foreign policy? Ethics really is at the core of all of this.
Well, so what you're saying, and I'm just trying to simplify this for some of our readers who are inebriated at this point, is the only way that they could have conceivably gotten through the inauguration is, not to mention all those in Russia who are typically inebriated. I'll just throw out a couple of things there, and then I'll turn to Corey and Julia. So for example, the president has said that what he's going to do is he's going to keep arm's length away from his businesses. He's going to let his sons run his businesses, which will still be called the Trump Organization, which he'll still own, and apparently which he will return to after the administration is over or his time in it is over. Does that pose any potential problems in terms of foreign policy in your mind?
Yeah, look, I mean, Trump has offered this plan to divest his interests or put them in a quasi-blind trust that are not recognizable as divestment or blind trust to anyone with even a passing familiarity of those terms. He's offered a plan. I think the near unanimous conclusion of ethics experts is that's not a divestment plan. That doesn't solve the conflicts. The real issue here is that Donald Trump is, we hear him say again and again, I can't have conflicts. The president can't have conflicts. He seems to be adopting either an expansive or a rather confused interpretation of basic separation of powers. It is true. Some of the ethics rules that apply to regular federal employees do not apply to the president of the United States. We've seen Donald Trump reject the statutory constraints, right? So he says the anti-nepotism laws don't apply to him and his family members. We also see him rejecting the constitutional constraints, right? He's saying that the emoluments clause doesn't apply. apply, or that it doesn't apply to the value for value trade of somebody staying at his own hotel. The problem is that separation of powers really is based on a notion of political constraint being a really important force in preventing the president from having these kinds of conflicts. Donald Trump thwarts that by not having any transparency whatsoever. So even though he's offered us this plan, which on its face is insufficient, he actually hasn't provided his tax returns, the financial disclosures, the kind of basic documentation the American people need to even as a baseline measure evaluate whether or not these interests are potentially clouding his thinking.
But there were all those stacks of papers. You saw
them.
Oh,
right.
That's great.
No one
that's
could
it.
Look in.
Yeah.
Yes. I thought that was a good trick. The menu,
and that
menu
lady
folders.
Got up there and just said void where prohibited about 800 times, mm-hmm, right? And mm-hmm. just did the rambling disclosure at the end of a commercial. Don't you think that's enough for most Americans?
Sadly, I think it's enough for a lot of Americans. I mean, it's sort of astounding, I think, to attorneys or people who are conscious and paying attention that he's getting away with this. But sort of the same strategy that worked again and again during the campaign of just sort of making a statement and then running after it like a freight train, creating your own truth and reality, that appears to be what they're trying to do in this case. You know, the problem is that there are very minor legal disputes, right? There is sort of a question about what exactly the application of the Emoluments Clause is. There is maybe a definition of whether or not the White House is an executive agency. These are minor legal disputes that no other president has really ever tried to test. They've tried to test in very minor ways because they respect that political accountability. So the problem is that, you know, Donald Trump, he offers these very small, the small blue sky, as though it gives him carte blanche to do basically whatever he wants. The only thing that's going to stop him at this point is if someone can establish standing in court, or if his approval numbers hit such rock bottom lows that he has to be responsive to people who are really, really concerned about this issue.
Well, first of all, as far as approval ratings go, let's keep in mind that this is a man who thinks he won a giant mandate when 8 out of 10 American voters didn't vote for him. So, you know, math is not his strong suit. But Corey, let me turn to you before I turn to Julia on this. You're not inside the Beltway. Set us straight here. We're worrying about technicalities. Real Americans don't worry about ethics, do they?
We are all real Americans. And
even the people inside the Beltway?
It is invidious to the Republic the way that people have in the last 10 years. The first instance I remember of it was Sarah Palin suggesting that, you know, only people who share her behavior and her views count as real Americans. And my own judgment is part of the reason we are having such an anti-establishment backlash is that none of us are doing enough to be inclusive of everybody's views. So with that aside, you know, I think we are
about to get—
I'd say
we've gotten you very choked up on this subject here, haven't we?
That's exactly right. I'm getting, if Joe Biden can get teary-eyed about winning the Presidential Medal of Freedom, I can get teary-eyed about the unity of our country.
It's very
helpful. So to the point about whether all of this matters, though, I do think it matters. I do think that President Trump is going to be embroiled in a constant conversation about the appropriateness and legality of his behavior. And I do think over time, that's just going to make everything harder for him. I noticed that there are certain sports figures, Mike Tyson, Richard Sheridan, who thrive on conflict and argumentation. I remember the opening scene of Bronte's Wuthering Heights where Kathy is being yelled at by her parents and all the servants simultaneously, and she could not be happier.
Possibly, by the way, that is the first Mike Tyson to Wuthering Heights transition ever.
I'm going to take that as a compliment, no
yep,
matter what you
sure.
meant it as, David.
I meant it as a compliment.
But Trump thrives on the conflict and turmoil surrounding him, but I'm not sure the rest of the country will. And And so that's the first thing. I think people are going to be exhausted of this before too much longer. And that may make them think none of these conflicts matter. My guess, though, is what it will make them think is it shouldn't be this hard, right? We ought to fix these problems. The great liberal state of California, I realize that's redundant several times over, is going to be to this administration what I think the state of Texas was to the Obama administration, which is a constant innovative legal challenge to the direction or to the specific activities that the president undertakes. They're now debating here in California, for example, passing a law that requires for a candidate to be on the ballot for president of the United States, to be on the ballot in California, it will be a requirement to release your tax returns.
Excellent.
So there are lots of ways that the dynamism of civic society and federalism can be used to hold the administration accountable. And I actually think we're going to get not just a great civics lesson, but a great surge of activism as people like us who actually do care about the accountability of the country's chief executive and both the perception and the actuality of compromise of the integrity of the office can find ways to hold them accountable.
By the way, I really love the prospect of the Republican Party taking up a fierce fight against states' rights as a result of this whole thing. Susan wants to say something briefly before I turn to Julia here.
Yeah, no, just since Corey's going so highbrow with Bronte references
Thank
and
you.
This beautiful vision of the Republic, my pushback, I'm going to go to decidedly lowbrow, and that's that my theory of Trump is akin to the concept of it's only kinky the first time. The primary check on a president is impeachment. And the problem is that if he gets away with this stuff for a little while. Each time it's okay and people aren't outraged, they don't kick him out of office, then he gets to do it again. And so whenever we are 6 months from now and sort of the political will potentially to remove him from office is there, you're not going to be able to impeach him because he's going to have 6 months worth of saying, well, I did this before and you weren't worried about it then. Why now?
Okay. That's an interesting point. Julia, I have a question for you, but I know you're nodding and gesticulating here, so you have some things to say. So why don't I just let you vent? And then
I side with Susan on this more, even though I love Corey, and I would love to believe that optimistic, beautiful vision of the Republic. I think we are getting a civics lesson. Unfortunately, it's a civics lesson basically in the breach of civics. And in addition to this idea of kind of Trump setting his own precedent over and over again, I'm sorry, I'm misusing all kinds of legal terms. You'll have to just bear with me. Politico magazine ran a piece this summer by a young political scientist named Yasha Monk, who has weighed in on this longstanding debate of norms versus laws and which are more important. And his argument is actually that liberal democracy, representative Republican democracy with small r, is actually quite fragile because a lot of this stuff is based on norms. So one of the examples he brought, which I found uniquely terrifying, was let's say Trump does something like this. Somebody gets a standing in court to sue him. It makes it all the way up to the Supreme Court. And even a Supreme Court that he has packed with his conservative justices says this is unconstitutional. You can't do it. And he says, meh, so what? Supreme Court,
as
what happens?
Andrew Jackson did over removal of the Cherokee.
Right.
Let the Supreme Court enforce this.
Yeah. So, I mean, they can't enforce it, right? This could be a very dangerous precedent. And it isn't just about whether or not he's impeached. It's also about whether or not after he does what he does for 4 years or 8 years, the various institutions that make up our republic have the same authority and legitimacy to do the things that they do.
I do want to note here that the president of the United States has been president for 4 days now, or just a couple of days, and we're discussing his impeachment. So that suggests that we're in very strange territory.
Yeah, and also, let's just note, I mean, you know, he hasn't been able to get out of campaign mode, which leads me to the point of the irony of the crooked Hillary moniker. The whole—much of— Donald Trump's campaign, other than building a wall and making America great again, was how crooked Hillary Clinton was. And look at her foundation and look at these pay-to-play schemes. And, I mean, it was very effective in turning the spotlight away from things that should have actually been exposed during the campaign. That what would it look like if he's president and he has all these business interests? And
well, that's part of the point, though, that Susan was making. He ran. She released her taxes. He didn't. He said people don't care. She said she had a foundation, which he attacked as being corrupt. But, you know, everything was on the record in that. His foundation, where nothing was really on the record and everything was extremely shady and actually broke a number of laws, was actually stopped by New York State from operating in the way that it was, behaved in a bad way. And he said people
don't. And scamming veterans charities.
And also, and then he goes and he writes checks to attorney generals from Florida, you know, to get him off the hook. And he says nobody cares. And then in the transition, he appoints her to a job. You know, I mean, the, you know, and on and on and on. So each time he tests the limit, he can treat women in a certain way and he gets away with it and he tests the limit. So I think that's the point. But, you know, we're foreign policy and we're not just sitting here to have a philosophical discussion about this thing. I think
I can conclude.
Well, no, go ahead. But I think we can all vent about this. You know, you've all gone to your different literary references. You know, to me, the literary reference I offer up is, you know, Marvel Comics. I blame Hollywood for making too many movies based on Marvel Comics because Trump is effectively a comic book villain. You know, he's a trope that appears in cheap Hollywood things about people in power. And he's sort of, that's where I think he's got a lot of his sort of imagery and sense of how people in power behave. But let's get to some specifics here, okay? One of the cases where the ethics questions are greatest and Trump has been murkiest is Russia. And I will start with you on this, Julia. There are a number of accusations that Trump has been compromised, not just by his behavior in Russia, which if you wish to comment on that, you certainly may, but by his associations in Russia. And he responded to this, naturally, via Twitter in an all-caps tweet, so that means it must be doubly true, in which he said, I have no ties to Russia, I have no deals with Russia, I've had no loans with Russia, or something to that effect. So how do you assess this?
Well, and you know, then there was the revelation that Mike Flynn, whom he has appointed to a very sensitive, high intelligence post, was texting.
Well, National Security Advisor, not intelligence, right? But yes.
But critical to
critical.
The intelligence.
That he was texting with the Russian ambassador here on the eve of Obama sanctioning the Russians for meddling in the U.S. election.
At exactly the same time.
And saying that he was wishing him a Merry Christmas, which, dare I say, is bullshit because the Russians celebrate Christmas not on December 25th, but on January 7th. So that is only one reason that it's bullshit. But it's compromising because For so many reasons. Like, do you have 3 hours? First of all, this is how the Russians play. So if, for example, you're in business in Russia, there's basically no way you can do business without breaking some laws. And it's specially designed this way so that every member of the commercial class is, or the merchant class, is at some point in violation of some law. And this is carefully noted and trotted out whenever somebody wants to take over that company, or that person gets a little too politically active, or they're, you know, caught up in some other kind of business dispute. So the Russians are always looking for sensitivities that they can exploit, whether they are commercial sensitivities, personal, licentious sensitivities that they can exploit at a critical moment. And the fact that they seem to have, you know, of course, this is uncorroborated, unverified, that they seem to be trying or seem to have something on Donald Trump is worrying. And this gets back to Susan's argument, very compelling and I think correct argument, that, you know, conflicts of interest are a national security interest. If you are vulnerable in this way, you are vulnerable to be exploited and can potentially be at least you can potentially be made to do things that are not in America's interest, but in Russia's interest.
Okay, well, let me ask you a quick question, mm-hmm. and then I want to turn to Susan on something, okay? So my quick question is this. Does he have no ties to Russia, or was that a complete lie?
Here's the thing. We don't know. And he could, of course, he doesn't want to, but his tweeting it doesn't prove it. This dodgy dossier that was released doesn't prove it.
But they, his company has done business with Russian oligarchs. His son-in-law and daughter have traveled with Rupert Murdoch's Rupert Murdoch's ex-wife, who's Putin's girlfriend.
Putin's girlfriend?
She has been.
It's rumored to be.
Yeah.
Like I think rumor,
but rumored to me. Like I think there is a lot.
We do know that he has had business relationships with Russian oligarchs who are close to the Putin administration.
I don't think that's quite true. I think they're not Russian oligarchs. They are kind of third tier or fourth tier businessmen who are Soviet immigrants to the U.S. who try to kind of pick up the crumbs off the table where the big boys sit, the actual oligarchs sit in Russia. And the fact that just to counter your point a little bit, and this came out in the dossier as well, and to me that part rang really true, where the Russians kept plying him with business opportunities and development and real estate opportunities in Russia, and he just couldn't do it, which is, I mean, only a fool couldn't build a Trump hotel in Moscow, given their, you know, dovetailing aesthetics.
Yes, and I saw the quotation marks over aesthetics even as you said it. Let me go to Susan, and then I want to come to you, Corey, and I appreciate the clarification there, Julia. One of my favorite Susan Hennessy tweets, and I have a list of them.
It's a big category for us all.
I'll make T-shirts and mugs.
T-shirts, yeah. We'll add them to our mug collection here. It was around the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act, where you sort of said, watch this space, and underscored why that's important. So maybe you could talk about that a little bit, because what Julia was talking about touches upon that.
Right. So I think it's difficult for Americans to understand the different ways in which Trump's lack of ethical practices could end up being a problem. So on one hand, just like Julia was referencing, it might incentivize him to place his own business interests above the interests of the American people. The other possibility is that he gets embroiled in actual criminal corruption. So the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act essentially makes it illegal to bribe a foreign government abroad, right? So in order to do business. We see lots and lots of FCPA violations in China, in Russia, in a lot of places in which we know that Trump has done business. I think Julia is being I know Julia is being like a very responsible, careful journalist as a non-journalist.
As an irresponsible.
Who's totally irresponsible. Right. I think there's a pretty large body of suggestive evidence that that Trump is not being candid in his
But and he, I think, is intentionally, I think this is one of the reasons he has not released his tax returns, which could clarify a lot of this stuff for us. And I think the fact that he isn't releasing them is kind of damning. And I'm sorry to interrupt, but he could easily, if he really has no deals and no loans and no debt in Russia, he could just show his tax returns and they would show that.
Right. So this is actually one of the ways in which the United States is really different from other countries. And that's the president's controller of the executive branch. So, for example, there's been recent reports that Netanyahu has been investigated on these corruption charges. That's reflecting governmental structure in which law enforcement and that part of the executive is actually sort of outside the presidency, right? Here in the United States, the president really sits on top of all those executive agencies, including the Justice Department, including the FBI, including all of the agencies that would be tasked with, investigating the criminal conduct of a businessman who went on to become president. This is where Trump's lack of transparency and his lack of interest in establishing legitimacy and credibility could have really serious consequences. Ordinarily, if there were some question about a president's conduct, they would appoint a special prosecutor. They would invite Congress to form a special commission or a select committee saying, look, I'm totally clean. I want to establish my credibility. You go ahead and investigate this. Donald Trump seems like the kind of person who he doesn't care so much whether or not you think that he's corrupt or whether or not you think he has something to hide. He's the kind of person that might just go ahead and say, order the FBI to not investigate him, fire people who decided to pursue that line of inquiry. And so we really could be faced with a sort of crisis point that I think goes to your earlier point from earlier in the episode about the fragility of norms and laws.
And it's not like it doesn't at least doesn't seem like a Republican-controlled Congress, which is very interested in being topped with a Republican president who can sign their bills or, repeals of bills, certain bills into law. It doesn't seem like they're willing to they're going to be willing to impeach him and or bring him down.
Well, wait a minute. Where's a Republican when you need one? Well, in
that's
Palo Alto.
California Republican.
Didn't she just say great liberal state?
Yeah, well, I think that was in quotes. So she says liberal the same way you say aesthetics. But
that's not true.
No, I understand that. But I think there is a legitimate question here, Corey, because actually some of the stirrings about Trump ethics have come from a couple of Republicans, and John McCain has passed along dossiers to the FBI, and Lindsey Graham has expressed some concerns about this kind of thing. On the other hand, you've got Jason Chaffetz, who's really proving himself to be one of the great assholes in the United States Congress, who says, "Well, I'm on the Ethics Oversight Committee, and that damn Office of Government Ethics is bothering the president by asking him to actually sort of stay within ethical guidelines. Maybe we should defund them," which is really he's gonna win some kind of an award for that, and if he doesn't, we'll come up with one and we'll give it to him. But is there, do you think, a scenario in which anybody in your party actually seeks to enforce these ethical standards on the president?
Yes, I do. But before we get to that, I want to appeal to all of our nerdy FP listeners to submit your suggestions for what the Chaffetz Trophy or award should be named.
Right.
I think you just named it.
The Golden Asshole Award?
The Golden Asshole Award.
Yeah, thank you.
So the answer to the question
Susan is grimacing. You know, she like does this lawfare podcast and they're all very,
this is
formal.
What your training, yeah. This is where it got you.
Yeah, that's why you went to law school, right? Go ahead,
so
Corey.
To answer the question, yes, of course, there are plenty of scenarios in which Republicans hold the president accountable. Most of them entail the American public holding Republican representatives responsible, right?
Midterm election may actually start to change people's views on this? If Trump's ratings are low and people want to get reelected, they may change their positions?
Of course. Or if proof emerges of compromising business ties between the president and Russian oligarchs, that kind of seedy stuff. Yes, of course, Republicans are going to be responsive to it, even the ones who aren't clarions of this. David pointed out it was John McCain handed the dossier over to the FBI. And there are a lot of good principled Republicans in Congress who are worried about the president's foreign connections, who worry about the emoluments clause, who worry about how being chained by party affiliation to somebody who's on a toboggan going over the edge of a cliff.
That's a good, that's another good idea. Listeners, if you can give us a good list of principled Republicans in Congress, we'll put their names on the side of an FP thimble.
I was going to say, their voices are so loud in Congress that they're all canceling each other out into a deafening silence.
It must be that. Julia, you were waving at me, or did you want to say something?
I did. I wanted to say something, and I wanted to say so many things that I'm losing track. One thing that I wanted to push back on is this idea that once people see, once voters see about the stuff, they will be concerned and they will push back and they will demand some kind of action or maybe vote him out of office in 2020. My experience in Russia and my observations of what's beginning to happen here are making me worried that that might not happen. And this is a question about the media here. It seems like our population is increasingly looking like the Russian population in terms of media consumption, where two sections of the population live in parallel and therefore non-intersecting informational planes. And if the Wall Street Journal this summer did a brilliant project called Red Feed, Blue Feed. One was topics trending on conservative Facebook, the other on liberal Facebook, and they were completely non-intersecting worlds. There were plots and names that, you know, on the conservative one, for example, that I had no idea who they were.
You were on the other world?
No, I was just looking into that.
No,
into
I just thought
yeah.
you weren't on the liberal plane.
I think the liberal plane is, you know, it's been lumped in with this, you know, quote unquote mainstream media, right? And that gets into these kind of anti-establishment feelings that Trump has been feeding. So, and I encountered this a lot when I was covering this election. There were a lot of voters out there who, some of whom were just reluctant Trump voters, but they were not interested in talking to me or hearing from me just because I came from the quote unquote mainstream media, and they would not believe what I say out of hand. And if it doesn't happen in their media, if it's not covered a certain way in these people's media universes or their Facebook feeds, then it didn't happen, and there's no outrage. And the outrage that's happening on our parallel plane of the universe is just that's the establishment. It's these effete D.C. Eggheads who are obsessing over these norms that, to I think a lot of people, look like, oh my God, he's using the wrong fork. That fork is for fish.
Well, let me ask a question, Susan, about this. Now, I'm not 100% sure I have all of your background correctly. But you worked as a lawyer in the intelligence community?
Yes, I was a lawyer at NSA.
Okay. So you have some perspective on some of these agencies that have an interesting ethical set of constraints on them as well. So recently, and I'll put it in parentheses here so our listeners know the whole truth, on the day that we taped this, which was 10 days before it actually aired, there was a congressional hearing on Russia. And in the congressional hearing on Russia, it was a closed-door hearing. The FBI director was in this hearing and apparently said to people that he refused to discuss the Russia investigation, even though it was a classified closed-door hearing. So the Democrats all stormed out, and they were outraged. Now, clearly, Comey's behavior on what he will discuss publicly and he won't discuss publicly is a little confusing, since he seemed to feel compelled to discuss the state of the Hillary Clinton investigation during the campaign, but did not feel compelled to discuss the fact that he was simultaneously undertaking an investigation into ties between the Trump administration and the Russians during the campaign. But it gets into an interesting question, because you or somebody mentioned a call to Flynn and the Russians, and the Trump team immediately said, oh, well, that was to discuss a future phone call. And I immediately thought, oddly enough, of the NSA. And I thought, somebody in the NSA actually knows what that was a call about. You know, somebody somewhere knows the truth. Somebody in the IRS actually knows what Trump's tax returns say. Somebody in the FBI knows where these things stand. And at a certain point—
Are you about to make a leak joke?
No, I'm not, and I'm certainly not going to make a leak joke and connect it to a Golden Showers report under any circumstances, if that's where you thought I was going. But it gets to an ethical conundrum. You work in the United States government. You swear an oath to the Constitution of the United States. You have a president who is seeking to subvert ethical standards or suppress information. You see that this all may actually put the country's national security at risk. Do you have an ethical obligation to actually disclose what you know?
So this is complex. I won't sort of get into whether or not it's the ethics of leaking classified information and the criminal conduct that might involve. What I will say is this is certainly something that people in the intelligence community are thinking about very hard. This sort of first emerged whenever Trump was set to get a set of classified briefings for the first time. And there was a lot of questions about, well, maybe you wouldn't give him information as president-elect. Well, maybe now you wouldn't give him information as president, right? That struck me as pretty—
Because he might give it to somebody else?
Right. So we have—
Mishandle classified information?
So now we have Haaretz and the Israeli press reporting that administration officials have warned them not to share information with the Trump administration out of fear—
Breitbart also reported this.
Okay. Well, yeah. There we go. Those are two. That's a big spectrum. Out of fear that it might be shared with the Russians or Iranians. I mean, these are people who take security very seriously. But look, at its core, the only thing worse than sensitive classified information in the hands of Donald Trump is a U.S. intelligence community that puts its personal judgments over the judgments of the American people.
Like exactly right.
The way to defend institutions is not to destroy the institutions, right? And so I think that it's really important to understand the rules, not as these buzzkill, you know, overly ethics rules, but really about sort of a basic protection of democracy. That said, you know, look, when you enter the intelligence community, you swear an oath to defend the Constitution against all enemies, foreign and domestic. And if there is a domestic enemy, and even if that domestic enemy is sitting in the White House, you have sworn an oath to your countrymen to defend them. And I think that while they will have a lot of challenges in how they ethically and legally and responsibly discharge that obligation. It's certainly something that I think they take really seriously. I think they hold it in their heart that it's really a part of how they think about, you know, their purpose, their mission, their job. You know, I don't envy them. I have to say it's an incredibly difficult choice that a lot of people are having to face right now.
This is so crazy. Can I just note that, like, how many times my jaw fell on the floor during what you were saying? I mean, it's crazy that we're even discussing things in these terms, that an enemy of the U.S. might be sitting in the White House, in the Oval Office.
Corey, this is Tom Clancy territory. Maybe we're just all overheated because we're here in D.C. in this tiny studio overlooking DuPont Circle. But you just said, you made an exclamation in the middle of all of this. So maybe you have some thoughts about it as well.
Yes, my exclamation was about people in government service making a judgment that they can't trust the people that the American public elected and determining that their judgment is superior. And the reason I was having that reaction, I grant that military and intelligence folks are in a different and unique category, but I do remember a pretty high level of irritation with the State Department during the Iraq War in 2003, determining that, you know, they understood American foreign policy better than the people that the American public had elected president, and therefore they were opposed to the Iraq War. And I think we need to be really careful about suggesting that, you know, all of us are so smart that the people that our domestic democratic processes put in power don't deserve the benefit of the doubt and don't have to be proven to be in violation before we take action independent of.
Can I just clarify between democratic processes and who the people have elected? Because Donald Trump was elected by the processes rather than, you know, the people. He lost the popular vote by 3 million people. 3 million votes.
And yet our electoral system is structured so that the popular vote gets filtered through the Electoral College. That's not new. It's not illegitimate that Trump got elected in that way.
But let me ask you a question. Let's all sort of, you know, buy into the fundamental soundness of what you just said. But there are people right now in the Central Intelligence Agency and the National Security Agency that know much more about Donald Trump's ties to Russia than we do. There are people in the IRS who know much more about Donald Trump's ties to Russia than we do. It is possible that some of what they know is compromising to him and suggests that he may be compromised. At what point is there an obligation for them to uphold the oath that Susan just referred to?
So can I say that, you know, if we look at the behavior that we're seeing, if we had an ethical intelligence community that was seeing something they were terrified of, something that they were willing to risk their necks and reputations over because they are so concerned about the threat, and yet they were also trying to abide by the rules, it would look a lot like what we're seeing right now, which is lots and lots of warning signs, right? The statement from DNI Clapper, right? So we now know that the FBI has known about these documents and this dossier for at least 7 months, sometimes sort of in July they were given this information. 7 months later, DNI Clapper issues a statement. This is the statement that he issued the day before yesterday about the conversation he had with Donald Trump. Now, in that statement, he could have said, "We've investigated these claims. They're ridiculous. There's nothing to this." That's not what he said. He said, "We have not yet determined they are reliable. However, we have an obligation to look into all matters which might affect national security." I think that if you are looking at really serious people that are trying to play within this system, that are trying to warn people, I don't know what more they could do in terms of trying to wave the red flag here of, hey, you know, Congress needs to pick up the baton here and really get serious about getting to the bottom of this in a committed, relentless way that is going to make the American people feel like they can trust that Donald Trump is actually acting in the interest of the United States and not in the interest of a foreign adversary nation.
Right. Now, you know, let's take a deep breath, because we are not saying here that there is any evidence that Donald Trump is acting in the interests of a foreign adversary nation. We are merely saying that there are multiple ethical obligations in play here, some upon the president and some upon people who work within the United States government. And there's a place where the assertions of the president, which do not have to be true, may run afoul of the knowledge of some of the other people within the United States government, or maybe in contradistinction to that, and that may create a problem. And we've seen that, right? We saw it during Watergate. We saw it when Richard Nixon said that he wanted to stop these things, or he wanted to fire people who were going to pursue these things. And people within the system kept standing up and saying, "No, you can't do that." And ultimately, the Watergate was the closest example to the scenarios that we're talking about here. But before we wrap up, and we've only got 5 minutes to go here, I want to talk about a different sort of set of the ethical issues, and that is the ethical issues associated with the president of the United States owning a company that is controlled by his sons, and that he is a beneficiary of, his daughter is a beneficiary of, whose daughter is married to one of his advisors, who is therefore a beneficiary of it. His future is dependent on it. His wife and his child are dependent on it. And that company has interests worldwide, about which we know nothing in a factual sense, but we do have some ideas. And we've already seen instances in which this president of the United States during the transition interacted with foreign leaders in a way that might be beneficial to his company. He met with the Prime Minister of Japan. His daughter and his son-in-law were in the meeting. She had a business deal in front of them. He spoke on the phone to the out-of-his-mind lunatic head of the Philippines and said what a great guy he was and what a wonderful conversation, while there was a Trump hotel deal in the Philippines worth $150 million. He has had conversations in Central Asia. He has had conversations with India. He has had conversations with multiple places where there were Trump deals. And he said, however, "Look, I just turned down a deal with Dubai. Therefore, I don't have conflicts of interest." I would like each of you to discuss this before we wrap up. Let me start with you, Corey.
Yes, the president needs to be much more careful about even the appearance of conflicts of interest. Yes, of course. what we are seeing already is responsive other governments, the Philippines, for example, making a Trump business partner their ambassador to the United States. That kind of tawdriness isn't good for the United States. It isn't good for American foreign policy. And it's going to create all sorts of odd perturbations in American foreign relations that the president would do the country well to avoid.
Very circumspect, very thoughtful. Julia, please be less thoughtful.
I would just reiterate what I said before about how a lot of this opens up avenues for pressing on Trump and his advisors and his family members, and therefore steering our foreign policy in a direction that is not necessarily to our benefit. It just creates vulnerabilities that can be exploited.
And that is known to world leaders, right?
They know of course. I mean, we're already seeing very soon after Donald Trump's election, we saw foreign dignitaries start checking into the Trump Hotel here in D.C. in droves in order to curry favor with the administration. Now, Trump has said that he would turn over the profits from those based off of those rooms to the U.S. Treasury, but he can still cover his costs.
I thought there was an ethical constraint against him.
And still market the hotel.
Yeah,
by,
yeah.
I thought he wasn't allowed to
security.
Own the hotel.
He's not. I mean, he's just as of January 20th, he will be in breach of that contract. The question is, what is anyone going to do about it?
Yeah, is anybody going to file suit?
That's fascinating.
Susan?
This is the conclusion of your first experience here. At the ER. Thank you for joining us. What is your view?
Yes, thank you, Susan.
Thank you for having me. So I will start by sort of standing on a soapbox and wrapping myself in an American flag and just reminding...
Which, by the way, listeners, she is actually doing.
I am. I have it out. It's a small step.
She has a real torch.
Yes. And a crown. And a beautiful American flag wrapped around me, and just reminding people for 1 second about what we are trusting this man with. There are, 480,000 U.S. troops that literally would die on the man's command. Foreign service officers, intelligence agents. I mean, we are trusting this guy with everything. And we see that Trump has this sort of mercantilist sensibility towards foreign policy, right? It's all quid pro quo, people doing their part. And that's actually something that has connected with his base a lot. They've really embraced it. The problem is that mercantilist sensibility, it has to be about our benefit, not his personal benefit. And so the more that it can be hammered home to Donald Trump's own base, that Donald Trump's interests and your personal interests do not align, and he is acting for his interests and not yours, I just think that is eventually the narrative that is going to have to take hold in this country if there's going to be any hope of accountability.
Thank you very much, Susan. Thank you, Julia. Thank you, Corey. This was the perfect podcast for the first full week of the Trump presidency. Good luck, America. Good luck, world. We've warned you. We've given the tools you need to understand and interpret this. And with some luck, we'll be back next week for more of the same. Thanks for joining us. You have been listening to Foreign Policy's The ER Podcast. I'm David Rothkopf, and I've been your host. The program is produced by Maria Ori and Ann Kingston. For more information about FP and to subscribe to this and our Global Thinkers podcast, please visit foreignpolicy.com, iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever you get podcasts. Thank you very much for joining us.